You're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
We have our monthly edition of Thirst for Knowledge, where we talk to the people who are running whatever Thirst for Knowledge event is on. Today, we have Charlie Bucock-Yee and Rosemary Presberger coming in to talk about a science communication competition, which is going to be held at Umbrellos tonight, 5 p.m., correct?
5:30.
5:30! But close enough. Close enough. How are you doing, both of you?
Doing good, thanks. Yeah, what about you?
I'm very chill. I'm super chill. How are you, Rosemary?
Doing great. Super excited.
Nice. You've found your found the office okay?
Yeah.
It wasn't a hazard to get here?
Not too much of a hazard.
That's good, because some people like have to call me or like take the elevator from this like student support kind of area, and yeah, it's an annoying place to find.
I could see it upstairs, so all I had to do was find the stairs.
And the stairs are kind of hidden, one might say, but I'm glad you both got up here. We're going to be starting off this chat by talking about Colossal, which is a biotech company based in California who recently announced they'd bought the direwolf back from the dead, which reeks of science miscommunication, because they really haven't done that. They've modified a grey wolf with some direwolf DNA to create something new. What did you guys read from the situation?
So I do a lot of paleo research, and very well invested in the space, and with this news that came out about the direwolves, it's been a bit hectic, I will say.
I can imagine.
Because everyone's kind of been in my ear going, this is amazing, and I've had to go, actually, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to break your hearts.
Well, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to have to adjust my glasses there. You're wrong.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's you have to break people's hearts. This is not a Jurassic Park moment. We're not actually bringing them back. It's amazing on the scientific front of showing this technology is possible.
Yes.
But unfortunately, these are not direwolves in the sense. These are very... the best way I can think to describe it is Game of Thrones-ified grey wolves.
Yeah, they're proxies is the term I've
heard.
They're
proxies. Yeah. And unfortunately, one of the big things that everyone's loving is they've got these beautiful white coats. But actually, from what we know about the genetics of the proper direwolves, they actually had these like brown coats. So these are very,
it's very Hollywood,
Game of Thrones, Hollywood-typed direwolves. Yeah. It's great to show the technologies there, but unfortunately, these are just hybridized grey wolves. They're not direwolves.
What do you think about it, Rosemary?
It's a bit kind of that. Like, they're so excited, they're so happy, they're really pushing out maybe not quite the truth, but at the same time, the more people just outside of the science space know about these things and get excited about these things, we're more likely to get, like, funding and interest in genetic projects and in conservation. So, at the end of the day, it kind of has a bit of a positive spin, even if the research itself, this particular research itself, might not be all that it's kind of hyped up to be.
That's a positive takeaway. It's a silver lining, at least. It's always a silver lining. You both aren't, I guess, professionally professionally trained in the science communication field, but you are taking a foray into it tonight with the science communication thesis competition, which is going to be very, very exciting. What about science communication appeals to you? Was there any kind of scientific issue or moment that you're like, oh, I want to do this?
Well, I think for me, growing up in a very non-scientific family, all my family members...
cavemen?
A little bit of a cavemen. Actually, they're all, they all do like dance and art and sort of thing. So it was really funny because they went, science, you want to go into this dinosaur thing? But actually, I was quite lucky growing up with Auckland Museum and being able to see all these amazing natural history things. It wasn't until later I had actually learned that most of them don't. They're not New Zealand native animals. They're kind of just picked from random places. But growing up, being able to go to the museum and places like Kelly Tartan's aquariums and stuff like that, being able to see all these amazing natural science locations and being exposed to all of that really gave me this sense of, if we can't relay the research that we're doing to the public, then why are we even doing it?
Yeah, totally. Before you go, Rosemary, just want to say big ups to museums. I love museums. What got you into science communication?
So I'm really into like all the creepies and the crawlies and the things that people don't really like. So, you know, parasites and bugs and all these things that people are kind of like, oh, I wish I could just get rid of them.
Yeah.
You can't. They're good. They're not bad. And so I want to be able to convince people that these things are good and they're not like gross or scary or something we need to get rid of. They're like part of the whole picture, part of the ecosystem, and they actually are beneficial and good. And the best way to do that is to just yap.
Yeah, and not you know, spray DDT everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I went to the Melbourne National Museum in February earlier, and you'd both love it because there's a beautiful real Triceratops skeleton.
Yes, and I actually went there at the end of 2023. There's an Australasian paleontology conference. That's where I met my supervisor.
Awesome.
So I got actually to see the unveiling of that beautiful Triceratops.
So good.
I don't know if you know, that is the most complete Triceratops in the world.
I'm not surprised.
It's amazing.
They also have an excellent bug section, just full of, it's like the animal attic, but like times 10. And only for bugs.
Going in July, and I'm so excited because there's a parasitology conference in Melbourne going to.
That's so beautiful. That's so beautiful. How was adjusting your writing style from, you know, in-depth technical scientific jargon to making it accessible and legible for, I guess, the layperson?
Difficult.
Yeah.
I think it's really hard to go in-depth to all the research you're doing and justify everything you're doing in the scientific realm to all these professionals and then have to really nicely put it into a little beautiful box for the general public to be able to understand. And I think the thing that we sometimes as scientists forget is, why is what we're doing important? Like, why does the average person care about what we do? And that's the thing we really need to try and keep at the front of our minds, because we sometimes get a bit carried away. So it's really great to be able to include the public in what we're doing, but it takes a little bit of it feels like there's almost like a barrier between scientists and the general public, because there's just this communication issue in the middle. And
yes.
So, you know, really trying to break down that barrier is something I would love to try and do via science communication.
And how do you find changing your writing style?
I have my own technique, which is most of my friends don't know anything about the things that I research. So every time I need to communicate something or I need to write something new, I round up all my friends and I say, I'm going to talk and you tell me if you can understand me. And then I just go from there and they tell me like what words, you know, might seem natural to me that I might want to define to other people, and just making sure that I can get the message across in a way that is accurate, but also in a way that's like engaging. That makes people want to listen to me in a way that's understandable. Because if you start using too many, you know, giant science
words, microbiota, taxata, defeta, all those Latin terms. Oof.
I work on microbiomes, so it is quite like, gotta. Sometimes, you know, I've spent so long doing this that there are words to me that I'm like, well, yeah, that's just the word that you use. And then my friends are like, hey, I've never heard that before.
And then they'll have words that you've never heard before.
Yeah.
I imagine.
Yeah, a lot of my friends are engineers,
toilet.
And I don't understand any of it.
RIP engineers. How does the event work tonight? What's the deal? I know it's a competition, but what's the actual like procedure?
So as far as
how is it
going to
be judged as well?
It will be judged based on how well we present and if we can really clearly explain what we're doing to not only engage the public, but actually get them interested in what we're doing and asking questions, because having a science communication competition like this is super amazing, but as far as I'm aware, it's mainly we've got 3 or 4 slides that we can use, and we're giving a 5-minute talk, and then we have 5 minutes for questions, and we'll be judged based on how well we can convey our research as well as how engaging we can be. There might be some other stuff that the judges have that I don't know, but as far as I'm aware, that's kind of the big takeaway for us.
Awesome.
It's 5 minutes for presenting, 5 minutes for questions, so you can harass the presenters for a little bit. and it's 3 slides and a title, but you can use props. So I've got like a really nice and super cool prop that might entice people to come.
Some stage theatrics.
Want to see like a nice real life parasite? I've got one of those to bring with me.
Awesome.
Like keeping people interested, being understandable, and also being like not just talking about nonsense for 5 minutes, like actually getting the research through.
Awesome. And I don't know if you saw my email yesterday, but I included a request for some pictures. Do you see that?
Yes.
Didn't see that.
Hey, that's okay. I was going to do a 30-second pitch, but we can skip that. I don't want you guys to feel unprepared or anything.
That's okay. I mean, I've got plenty of little pitches, depending on what you're interested in.
Yeah,
talking about worms.
I want to hear. Nothing longer than 30 seconds, and like a general pitch about your general rundown of your research. If you'd like to do that,
absolutely. Shall I go first? All right.
Okay, I'm just going to get my timer ready.
All right, timer. Here we go.
And if you go over 30 seconds, you'll get a nasty zap. We're starting.
Got it.
Now.
All right. My research looks at 20-million-year-old fish, and they're ideally we want to measure the growth of these fish and get an idea about the elements trapped in some of their bones. And so we read the elements in there, and we can make interpretations about their life as well as the environment that they lived in, and that helps us with modern and future conservation of those descendant species.
Perfect. It was with 5 seconds to go.
Oof.
Awesome. Your turn, Rosemary. You ready?
Yeah.
Awesome. 30 seconds starting now.
So I work on parasite mind control, parasites that can change the behavior of their host. And in particular, I'm researching how they do it. So I work with the world's weirdest Russian nesting doll. Inside the cave weta is a worm, and inside the worm are viruses. And I look at how the worm uses its viruses to help it manipulate its host.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And again, 10 seconds on the clock. You have plenty of time.
Oh, great.
Got a couple of experts.
He's got us lined up with little zappers.
Right in your chair. Right in your chair. I think you're pretty lucky to be working in the parasite mind control field. How, The Last of Us is a very big popular TV show at the moment, and that's all about fungal parasites that take over people's minds. Kind of similar, like cordyceps, right? That's the whole premise of the show.
The amazing diversity of types of parasites, that can manipulate their host all the way down to parasites that are only one cell, and they can still cause these huge behavior changes in their host, and parasites that aren't even animals that can still do these crazy things the cordyceps that infects ants, which is what I think The Last of Us is based on. It causes them to climb up trees and then they spore.
Yeah. Which is super sick. I've got one question for each of you based on your specific research. I'll start with you, Rosemary. Your research focuses on how hairworms manipulate cave weta, and you've likened the interplay of parasite versus host to an arms race where the host develops defensive capabilities and systems, and the parasite develops new ways to sabotage these implements. Who's winning in the hairworm versus weta arms race, and what does behavioral manipulation of weta by hairworms look like?
I think I'll start with the behavioral manipulation. Mm-hmm. So the hairworms have this interesting little life cycle where they grow up inside of a weta, but they need to reproduce in water. So their whole goal is, how do I get from inside this thing to into the water? So they cause this attraction where these weta will literally jump into streams, which is fatal for the weta. Mm. But then the worm is able to come out the back, wrap around some sticks, and they find each other that way.
Wow.
So it's one of the really dramatic examples. I did a little behavioral thing where I have a video of one of my weta climbing into a water dish, and that one ended up having a bunch of two worms inside of it. Whoa. But they were quite big.
I need to ask, do the worms come out the butt?
They do come out the butt.
Oh my god.
I do have a video of a weta kind of sticking its butt down into water and two worms coming out the end.
And can they do that without the weta dying?
The weta doesn't have to die. There are times where the worm will come out and it won't die, but because it gets in the water, usually it dies because of that, and sometimes it does.
So it kind of just perk its little butt on the water and just have them come out, and then that'd be peaceful?
Yeah, sometimes it does that. Sometimes you watch it, there's videos of them just kind of backing up into the water and sticking their butt down in, and sometimes they just jump all the way straight in.
Fire out. And in terms of who's winning the arms race, I guess it seems like it's the hairworms for now, right?
Yeah, for now. But it's just kind of, I feel like it's always even. One of them gets ahead, and then the next one gets ahead, and then the other one figures out how to get back ahead, and they're just always kind of pushing back and forth between each other.
Eternal Cold War.
Yeah.
Cracker. And for you, Charlie, your research focuses on ancient otoliths, which are fish ear stones of extinct fish from the Bannockburn Formation in central Otago. Analysing these otoliths and others from Te Papa, you can learn about what the certain fish's life cycle and habitat looked like. How do you excavate these otoliths? And what have you learned about the Miocene Lake Manu Hidikia and some of the extinct species who lived there?
So those are amazing questions. Let's tackle the first one for excavating them. When we're out in the field, we've got maybe a dozen sites that we kind of go between. And what we're trying to do is, because these are so small, they're like a millimeter.
Whoa.
You'll never go and find them in the field. So what you're doing is you're just getting massive chunks of sediment that look like they contain quite a lot of bones in them. And you put them into a sieve, and we have like a river that passes down near the sites. And so we'll just, almost like gold panning, you sieve the sediment in the river, and that gets rid of all the sediment and just leaves the bones. So if we can sieve as much of that as possible in the field, it makes it really easy to take back to the lab and then pick through what remains, and we can find all the otoliths under a microscope like that. So that's the best way for us to do that, is just massive chunks, sieve it out, bones are all that remain. It's almost like a like those like sand pits when you're a kid and you're just trying to like find things under there. It's like the professional version of treasure hunting.
That's so cool.
It's very cool. That's but awesome. Yeah, in terms of what we've learned from Lake Manu Hidikia, the massive big overall question we have right now is this lake landlocked, or is there a way to the ocean? Because right now, all the evidence we have for the last 20 years in the literature is circumstantial. It's all, yeah, maybe, not really sure, yeah. So these otoliths will give us a definitive answer for that question, for the fish that will be spending a period of their life in the ocean and then coming back into freshwater environments in the lake to spawn. Other things we really want to learn is, like, the age. Because right now, our age range is about 11 to 20 million years, and 9 million years is quite a big error margin.
That's a massive gap.
It's a very big error margin. So if we can narrow that down, that would be great. So we want to age the otoliths themselves, but we also want to have a look at the elements inside, trapped in the otoliths, because they're kind of like little time capsules. Mm-hmm. And so if we can crack them open and read the little fish diaries, then we can learn things like, how deep was the lake in certain sections? How shallow was it? Can we see migratory movement of these fish? Really just trying to rebuild things like temperature as well of the water. All of this would be really helpful, because right now the best thing we have for temperature in the literature is modern day Townsville. But is that winter? Is that summer? We don't know. So it's really just, can we narrow down all the existing stuff from, yeah, it's about this range, to, yeah, it's going to be this more definitive range here. So that's really what we're trying to pull off.
Just getting a better picture.
Exactly.
Better picture.
Get all some clarity.
Yeah, hell yeah. All right, thank you both for coming on the program today. It's at Umbrellos 5:30. There's like six of the competitors, right?
Yes. So there's two competitors from zoology, which is myself and Rosemary. We have two from ecology and two from geology.
Awesome. Good spread of the sciences there.
Exactly.
Are there any final words you'd like to leave the audience with?
I would just like to say, spoiler alert for The Last of Us, but Joel made the right choice.
I think just everyone should get more into worms. They should like worms more than they do. And just, parasites are great.
Yeah, I should probably say an actual thing. Dinosaurs are great. We love them. Unfortunately, in New Zealand, we don't really have a dinosaur record, but that doesn't mean we don't have a cool fossil record. So more people should try and have a look at the fossils that we have, because they're pretty amazing. And if you are in Otago, have a look at the new Moa footprints that have just been unveiled in Te Huta, because they are fascinating.
Yeah, I bet. And also, if you're in Otago, go down to Curio Bay and look at the Petrified Forest, because there's a whole lot of fossils there. The whole place is a giant fossil. Anyway, thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you so much for
having us.
Of course. Folks, that was Charlie Pukokie and Rosemary Pressburger, who are participating in a science communication competition at Umbrellos tonight. They've requested two tracks. Charlie's requested Tame Impala, Let It Happen, and we've got Grumpster with Growing Pains from Rosemary. We're going to hear Tame Impala, then Grumpster, and then around 9:45 we'll have Clowning Around. You're listening to The One. Keep it locked.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.